This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Illinois' new governor, J.B. Pritzker, took office this week. Coming up this hour, an interview with him about his policy agenda and some of the problems facing the state. We look back at a bygone era, that of the downstate dealmakers, whose backroom scheming benefited their areas, but also allowed them to profit.
We can look at that, I think, in hindsight, and we can say, gee, that was probably not healthy, but that was the way it was, and that was the way that business was done then. No matter what era you're working in, it depends on what you can get done.
The state has awarded its first posthumous exoneration. We'll have that story. And with more talk about hemp and marijuana, we'll lay out the differences between the two. That and more this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A lot ahead this hour. We'll sit down with the new governor, J.B. Pritzker. We'll also remember the dealmakers of downstate Illinois. And what connection exists between opioid addiction and suicide? Those stories and more today on Statewide. First up, the former Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner managed to make some state history on his way out of office. He granted a pardon to a man wrongfully convicted of murder in the 1980s. But the man he pardoned, Grover Thompson, had died decades earlier. That makes him the first to receive a posthumous pardon in modern Illinois history. Sam Dunklaw met with one of Grover Thompson's relatives this week in Springfield, along with some of the people who helped in getting the pardon.
John Hanlon directs the Illinois Innocence Project at the University of Illinois in Springfield. It's a legal group whose mission is to free people who are sitting in Illinois prisons for crimes they didn't commit. Since 2003, they've helped nearly a dozen people prove their innocence. And this week, Hanlon spoke to the media about one other person they'd helped.
Welcome to this gathering pertaining to the posthumous grant of clemency based on actual innocence that has been granted to Grover Thompson.
Almost every other time Hanlon has announced something like this, he's had his client standing right next to him. But not this time. That's because Grover Thompson died behind bars more than 20 years ago. Hanlon says his group usually doesn't look for posthumous cases like this one, but when Thompson's family came calling, they answered.
Grover Thompson was just as wrongfully convicted as any living exoneree. Grover Thompson suffered all the different things that exonerees suffered. There's only one difference. He didn't get to walk out.
Thompson was a black man from Chicago who seemed to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. On September 7th, 1981, he was traveling on a Greyhound bus, which stopped before sundown in the southern Illinois town of Mount Vernon. Thompson didn't like to travel at night, so he got off the bus and looked for a place to sleep, settling on a nearby post office. At nearly the same time, a woman in an apartment building across the street was stabbed by an attacker who had snuck in through her bathroom window. He escaped before police arrived, but witnesses said the assailant was black. Since Thompson was the only black man found near the scene, they pegged him as the suspect. Before long, an all-white jury gave Thompson 40 years in prison. Thompson's nephew, S.T. Jameson, remembers when he heard the news.
It was so depressing, so chilling, that a man like him had been accused of such a heinous crime.
Jameson says Thompson was a funny, hard-working man who played blues on the guitar like nobody could.
Every time I go home to Mississippi, my family, we laugh and tell jokes about some of the things he said and did.
Nothing seemed to add up in Thompson's case. He wasn't wearing the same clothes witnesses said the attacker wore and had no trace of the victim's blood on him anywhere. But he sat in prison for nearly 14 years anyway, dying there in 1996. That's when retired police lieutenant Paul Eccles came in. He'd been investigating another man, Tim Kreicher, for a string of murders and rapes. Kreicher had been in prison for other crimes when, in 2008, he confessed to stabbing a woman in Mount Vernon, the same crime Grover Thompson had been picked up for.
This is not what you want to hear. You don't want to hear that somebody else has been arrested for a crime that he had committed in this case.
In 2012, Grover Thompson's family partnered with Eccles and the Innocence Project and put in a formal clemency petition to Illinois' Prisoner Review Board. By state law, the governor has the final say on granting clemency, which he or she can give at any time. Though former Governor Rauner initially denied Thompson's petition in 2015, he reversed course just days before he left office, giving him a full pardon. S.T. Jameson says the pardon means just as much to his family, even if it's 23 years after the fact.
We cannot bring this beautiful man back, whom we love so much, but we can clear his name, and that's been what the family has wanted to do all these years.
Lieutenant Eccles apologized on behalf of those who put Thompson away, saying police like him really do want to see the right thing happen.
We have the ethical responsibility to get it right, because when we get it wrong, the true suspect goes on and commits crime.
According to the National Registry of Exonerations, Thompson is one of less than 24 people nationwide who have been given pardons after their death. If he had lived to see his, Grover Thompson would be 84. I'm Sam Dunklaw.
Illinois has a new governor.
I, J.B. Pritzker,
do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States.
J.B. Pritzker took office this week, and before he was sworn in, the state's top executive sat down with Brian Mackey for a conversation focused on his policy agenda, the problems facing Illinois, and ethics in government. Today we hear what he had to say.
Experts have said if politicians really want to bring down the prison population and end mass incarceration, you have to be willing to look beyond the nons. This is nonviolent, non-serious, non-sexual offenders. And so I wonder, in order to get serious about criminal justice reform, are you willing to look beyond the nons?
You know, I have one of the great criminal justice reform advocates and restorative justice experts as my running mate, and that's Juliana Stratton. And we're creating an Office of Criminal Justice Reform and Economic Inclusion. You know, much of what our focus is on is not just avoiding recidivism and reducing the prison population by, you know, by perhaps having, you know, different sentences, but also keeping people out of prison in the first place. We've got a lot of work to do in this field. This is not, you know, I know that there were some criminal justice reform proposals that were passed and implemented in the last administration, but there's a whole heck of a lot more that we can do. And again, I'm working with Juliana to make sure that we're going to implement those policies.
But if you were sentenced for murder before the mid-90s, it might be a 20-year sentence. And now it's a 40, 45-year sentence. Could that be lower?
Murder, obviously, is a very, very serious crime. So I'm not looking right now at reducing sentences of people that have committed heinous crimes. But one thing that we're going to do, as you know, is to legalize, tax, and regulate cannabis and for recreational purposes. And there are people who have touched the system. This is one area, you know, that have been put in prison for things that under a new set of laws would not be illegal. And so we've got to look at the commuting those sentences, pardoning, you know, all the various methods that are available to a governor to reduce sentences and expunge records.
Although, as you know, very few people are in state prison for just marijuana offenses.
Well, some people who, you know, went into the business, so to speak, of selling marijuana are. And so we'll be looking at that. But, I mean, look at how the laws are prosecuted today. When you say prison, how about jail? You know, the jails are often full too. And that's another thing I just want to point out is, you know, a lot of the people who end up in jail, as you know, have mental health issues. And if you want to talk about criminal justice reform, you got to talk about the holistic issues facing the people who end up in the system. That's how we're going to prevent recidivism, and it's how we're going to prevent people from actually going to jail or prison in the first place.
So let's turn to higher ed. You said you want to lower the cost of college for everyone in Illinois. The Illinois Board of Higher Education wants a funding hike this year of 16%. You're smiling. But this is for grants for low-income students as well as just university operations. They say there's no other major area of the state budget that's funding level is below where it was in 2002. Can you approve that 16% request?
Well, you know how committed I am to making sure that there is affordability for people who want to go to college. I'm also focused on vocational training because there are an awful lot of kids who choose not to go to college but need to get the skills necessary to get a good job. But when it comes to higher ed, we have a lot of work to do in the state. You know that I've advocated for expanding the AIM High scholarships. I've advocated for expanding in a significant way the MAP grant program to 70,000 more kids. Lots of people, you know, apply for a MAP grant and then they qualify, but they don't get it because they run out at a certain date. And so I just want more people to have the opportunity to stay in Illinois. This is one of the great problems when we talk about the exodus from our state, is that young people are getting up and leaving, and their families are too, because they can, you know, get a better deal if they move to another state and take in-state tuition there.
Does 16% sound like a reasonable request?
Right now, I would say we have a lot of fiscal challenges in our state. So you know that I'm committed to lifting up our universities and making sure that we've got proper funding for them. But I, as to 16%, I wouldn't comment about the specific percentage, just to say that I agree that our universities and colleges are underfunded.
Speaking of the budget and the fiscal pressures on Illinois, late last year, S&P said that S&P Global Ratings said Illinois government finances are at elevated risk in the event of another economic downturn or a recession, and that there hasn't been enough focus among Illinois policymakers to tackle the structural deficit, the backlog of bills, in the event of an economic downturn or a recession. And since your progressive income tax proposal is at best 2 years out, would you consider raising the flat tax to help shore up state finances?
No, I'm committed to getting a graduated income tax for the state through a constitutional amendment. In the meantime, you know, we've got to look at bringing efficiencies to state government. You know that we're in the midst of a what is now, I think, in year four of a massive computer infrastructure upgrade for the state that hasn't yet gone into effect that will help us bring efficiencies. There are lots of other things that we'll do from each one of our agencies in state government to bring down costs and also raise the level of service that's being offered to people. We do have elevated risk. You just, you know, said something that seems obvious to me, which is there are no reserves in state government. If we had a brief recession, it would be certainly deleterious to the state in a major way. I am focused on balancing the budget this year, and it's why I've been very serious about bringing people in who I think are committed to that. But that team, our collective team, and my individual focus on getting it right means that we'll be in a better position next year than we are now. But you're right. I mean, we've been left 4 years now that you know, state government has gotten much worse, its financial condition.
So does that mean the flat tax stays where it is? Or, I mean, are you open to changing that if Illinois, because the last time we had a recession, state finances went through the floor.
My intention is to focus on the graduated income tax as a constitutional amendment.
More state legislators than I can count have resigned from the General Assembly on one day, and they become lobbyists the next, often working in the very issue areas they were active as legislators. Former State Representative Lou Lang, who resigned last week, could be working on sports betting and cannabis legalization. Should the revolving door be locked for state legislators the way it is for executive branch officials?
There's a lot that we need to do in terms of ethics. That's something you'll hear more from me about during the course of the, you know, my first month in office. I just think that there hasn't been enough focus on it. It's something, unfortunately, Illinois is not known for its high ethical standards that have been, you know, breached by a number of people. So we've got to look at all of these issues and ask, you know, where are we getting it wrong and where should we be clamping down? But I don't disagree that there are conflicts of interest that need to be eliminated or diminished significantly.
Is the revolving door one of them, though? Should that be locked?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, well, I guess what I would say is that we have a citizen legislature, and so people have to be able to go earn money when they leave. They're going to earn money while they're in the legislature too, in other professions. And as long as we have a situation like that, where people are not full-time legislators and barred from having outside employment, this is going to be a real issue.
But you're not going to weigh in then on whether specifically there should be a prohibition on legislators becoming lobbyists right away.
Well, you'll see our ethics proposals that we're going to put forward. And I'm very focused on making sure that we've got, you know, a highly ethical government.
Last week, your transition announced a system by which your top staffers would be paid not only by the taxpayers, but also by you personally through a limited liability corporation. How can you assure the people of Illinois that your staff will be loyal to them and not to the man who is giving them private pay for public sector work?
Well, each of them has agreed that they are working for the state and not for me. They are state employees. I've been very transparent about what we're doing. I think that's not been the case with everybody that's served as governor. And it's very important to me that each one of them knows that they work for the taxpayers of the state. Now, as you know, with the combination of the new offshoring prohibition that was passed last year because of Governor Rauner using people from other agencies as you know, part of his governor's office, as well as the fact that salaries really have not been commensurate with the quality of the talent that I think we should have in the governor's office. That's why I set it up this way. I didn't want to cost the taxpayers more. In fact, this costs the taxpayers less. Because many people are being paid less from the state government. They're actually going to get a smaller pension as a result of that. And I think this ends up being very good for the taxpayers. And they are committed. They are, you know, taking their own sort of, you know, oath that they work for the people of the state.
Doesn't this lend credence to the idea that we are becoming an oligarchy? You have to be a independently wealthy person who can supplement the salaries because the taxpayers can't afford to do it?
Well, we need to deal with the fiscal challenges of the state so that, you know, people can get paid properly in the positions that they're in, that we've got the leeway to do that. Look, I just chose some extraordinary people for whom, you know, they're making multiples of what they will be making, even with the additional income that they're getting. And they were willing to take that salary cut. To come do the right thing for the state. But many of them, you know, have multiple children in college and, you know, they've got other commitments. And so I wanted to make it as fair as I could for them as well as for the taxpayers. And so I've taken that burden on myself.
That's the new governor, J.B. Pritzker, talking with R. Brian Mackey. Pritzker was sworn in on Monday. Next up on Statewide, we'll recall the dealmakers of downstate Illinois. We're back on Statewide. We're in an era when Chicago-area politicians dominate state governments, but it wasn't that long ago that some of the more powerful state leaders came from southern Illinois. A book details their careers. It's called The Dealmakers of Downstate Illinois, Paul Powell, Clyde Choate, and John Stell. And I talk with the author, a former journalist, Robert Hartley. We begin talking about why he chose to focus on these men and their era.
I think that I was intrigued by the time period when the Illinois legislature and governor's office was pretty deep into cutting deals for public policy. And it was a time when those deals could be cut because of the way the legislature was constructed. And I'm sure you're familiar with cumulative voting. Even though a single party had control of the House or the Senate, the votes of the number were very close, and so just a few trades of votes could cut some deals that didn't depend strictly on partisan control of the houses of chambers of the legislature. And some members of the legislature were more adept at cutting deals and making deals than others. And what I have discovered in writing several books about Illinois politics is that in the time period of the after World War II in the 1940s, 50s, and 1960s, the dominant deal makers and politicians were from southern Illinois.
Let's talk about these three individuals and what they were able to accomplish.
They were able to work with Chicago and with the Democrats, but the Democrats and Republicans downstate tended to have enough votes to get pretty much what they wanted The principal dealers during that time period were Paul Powell, Clyde Choate from southern Illinois, from deep southern Illinois, and John Stell, who wasn't a member of the legislature, but Stell was a downstater with lots of political clout, particularly with the veterans of World War I and World War II, who still populated and were very active politically. And Stell also had a lot of personal money, and he was able to invest in different Republicans and Democrats. He was a Democrat, but he crossed the line a lot. And he worked with Powell and with Choate on things like racetrack legislation and other subjects, common school taxes and all. And they formed a coalition that reached out into all areas, particularly of downstate Illinois. And because Powell was a Speaker of the House and also a minority leader much of the time that he was in the legislature, he simply was able to do pretty much what he wanted. Choate became his understudy and worked with him. He was the vote counter, I think, in the legislature. And then when Powell moved on to the Secretary of State's job, Choate took over the leadership of those coalitions that worked on subjects like the income tax that was passed in 1969, and Choate was very active in getting some changes in that proposal. So Choate then continued to work the coalitions successfully until he retired in 1977.
It really was a different era in government. We think today of all this backroom dealing and think of it in a negative way. It was not looked at the same way back in those days.
There was simply a lot of crossing of the partisan lines in order to get social legislation. Higher education was a big subject. It really, without the deal making, SIU would never have grown as it did in that time period, and all higher education schools, institutions benefited from the deal making with the in the legislature and with the governor at that time. The various governors, they all recognized that they could work various coalitions and get their subjects passed as well. It was a different time, and it was a different political picture in Illinois. So different that people today who are schooled in Illinois politics have a hard time understanding how that could have happened.
A lot of people today, they look at the backroom deals and, you know, they give something for a vote, and they view that, I guess, tied in as corruption in Illinois government. And in some cases, certainly it has been used that way. And even back in this day, there was corruption that took place. But it was also a necessity to do the work that way to get things done, wasn't it?
Well, pretty much so. I think, as one person suggested about these three individuals, that none of them were choir boys, and I think they all pushed the envelope a lot on ethics. They lined their pockets with money based on legislation that was passed, particularly with racetrack ownership. There was no question that it was a time before disclosure of campaign contributions and personal wealth, and so money moved around a lot. Now, you can call that corruption, and I suppose to a certain extent it was. But on the other hand, that's the way votes were gathered in that time period, a lot.
You also used the term ethical flexibility. I thought that was an interesting term to try to come up with there. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that nobody was particularly alarmed proclivities of payoffs of substantial help for campaigns to get votes, campaign money. Nobody got particularly alarmed about that. Oh, there were some individual legislators. Paul Simon was a good example, who tried to open up disclosure and reveal some of the things that were going on. But they were not successful until, sort of the 60s and 70s is when the disclosures became more evident. And people simply accepted that that was the way of doing business. Now, there were always a few people who resisted that, but by and large, if you wanted to be successful in that time period, particularly in the legislature, if you wanted to have your bills passed, if you wanted to get good assignments on committees, then you played ball, and you played ball with Paul Powell and his friends, his pals, because they could cut the deals. And that simply was, we can look at that, I think, in hindsight, and we can say, gee, that was probably not healthy in some respects. And I think I would agree with that, that certainly we hope that disclosures in laws today will minimize that kind of corrupt activity. But that was the way it was, and that was the way that business was done then. And what you know is, no matter what era you're working in, it depends on what you can get done. What results can you get, and how can you get them?
We're talking with Bob Hartley. He's a former journalist and the author of The Dealmakers of Downstate Illinois, Paul Powell, Clyde Schott, and John Stell. Well, that area, and I grew up in southern Illinois where these gentlemen are from, and even though they've been out of power now for more than a generation, they're still pretty highly thought of in that area, despite this ethical flexibility that you talked about. I guess that goes back to getting those things done, bringing back things to the districts.
Yes, that was uppermost in their minds. These three and their cohorts in southern Illinois, downstate, was to get some local programs through, get some bridges built, and open up some parks, and of course SIU was a big economic item in their minds. John Stell went to college, but Clyde Schott and Paul Powell, they never darkened the door of a college in their time. But they were big supporters of the university, primarily from an economic development standpoint. And so part of the working of the legislature was to get votes, to get people work in the coalitions that cut the deals. You had to give them something for their local districts. And there was a regional political emphasis on helping southern Illinois, which was always a little bit on the downside of the economic list, helping southern Illinois, particularly as Chicago and the suburbs grew. A lot of the deal making was to help the economic development in that area. People remember that, and they remember it for generations. It's amazing, really, how the works of Schott and Powell could long last almost any other people down there, because they were very attentive to local projects and patronage, and so state jobs, and everybody was willing to cut a deal for some state jobs, and that helped the area as well. Now, we know now in the lineup of politics in the legislature and state that much of the effort and all goes to the suburbs and to Chicago, and the southern Illinois downstate political effort is hurting. And I think the difference is that there's been a change in the laws and a change in the voting patterns of people in the state.
Do you think when you look at government today, and I'm not going to say it's less corrupt or more corrupt or anything like that, we don't really know until investigations come out. When you see the inability at times of getting things done, is that where a deal maker from the past, like a Paul Powell or like a Clyde Schoed, they could be more than helpful in getting things accomplished in this type of climate?
Well, of course, I think that it's fairly easy for someone like me to say, gee, look at how things got done, and then look how we can't get things done now. And the as I said earlier, the times were immeasurably different. What is missing, and I think that this is the part that that hurts the most. What's missing are those coalitions that cut across partisan lines, and the partisanship, I think, in the state of Illinois at this time, and it has been so for a number of years, simply doesn't put much of a premium on working together and cutting across those lines to get things done. And so I think that if there's a major difference, there's always a difference in personalities, of course, but in a major difference, there needs to be an incentive for getting things done. If you look at the two governors that we can think of most recently, beyond the ones who are in jail, to Jim Thompson and to Jim Edgar, they were, as Republicans, they're almost all the time that they served, the legislature was controlled by Democrats. But if you go back and look at what got done and the programs that got cut and that were done, the deals that were done, my goodness, Jim Thompson was a great deal maker. They were able to cut across those lines. They were able to do enough work with the Democrats to get things that both the Democrats and the Republicans wanted. It really was as close to those earlier days as anyone has gotten in recent times. And part of that was that the Republican governors were willing to deal with the likes of Mike Madigan, the Speaker of the House, who was in control of the House in those days. And they knew that he wanted things. And he knew that they wanted things, and that's when things get done.
Was there anything else you wanted to mention or point out that maybe people misunderstood about these fellows or things you'd like to get across to them?
I think what is important is for us to know that there was a time, call it what you want, there was a time when some things got done. And if you look at some of the institutions that exist even today, you can trace them back to their growth and development to those days in the 50s and 60s, and even in the 70s when a lot of things got done. And I don't mean just racetracks. I'm talking about social programs as well. And the state income tax was a major factor in all of that. So in those time periods, even though they changed somewhat as they moved along, they still were able to work to get things done and to get them done to make the whole state happy and feel good about it. And I think if you understand that and don't try to get too carried away with the corruption subject or the ethical subject, if you look at that, then you understand how different it is. It doesn't mean that it's going to change or in change for the better, but it's sometimes better to have that perspective when you're looking at your state.
Robert Hartley is the author of The Dealmakers of Downstate Illinois, looking at the careers of Paul Powell, Clyde Schoed, and John Stell. You can find out more about that book at our website at statewideshow.com. Just ahead on the program, Hemp and Marijuana. Do you know the difference? We'll shed some light. Stay with us. Welcome back to Statewide. Is there a connection between the rise in opioid overdoses and an increased number of suicides? Well, that story's still on the way. But next, when people hear the word hemp, many associate that with marijuana. And they would be right. Hemp is derived from the cannabis plant, but there are some important differences between the marijuana people smoke and industrial hemp. Jacqueline Driscoll sat down with Chance Riggins, he's a crop science professor at the University of Illinois, to weed out the differences and similarities.
Industrial hemp and marijuana are both subjects of interest, I would say, particularly in the news here in Illinois, with the passage of the industrial hemp program and the discussion about legalizing recreational marijuana. But they are very different, even though they are the same plant. So can you talk about some of those differences?
Well, they're both the same plant. We're talking about plant that is cannabis sativa in the law. So botanically, they're the same thing. They're just two different varieties or cultivars. So right now, the Farm Bill established a definition based on the level of THC, the tetrahydrocannabinol, the Delta-9 form of that compound that is responsible for the psychoactive properties. And that limit is set at 0.3% on a dry weight basis. So that is the definition that was established by the Farm Bill.
So as you mentioned, hemp and marijuana are both the same plant. But thinking about physical characteristics when, say, someone is just looking at the plants, a hemp plant and a marijuana plant, would someone be able to distinguish a difference?
Well, another way to think about this, so there's no real physical difference in the plant. There are different growth forms, different cultivars, depending on what the intended product is. You know, fiber production, chemical extraction, you know, there's a whole series of products that can be derived from this plant, you know, just based on how it's grown and what the intended product is going to be. But in the field, I mean, They look the same, they're going to smell the same, they're both resinous. Obviously, the one cultivar that's grown for fiber is going to be tall and not produce a lot of, you know, leaves or flowering tops, inflorescences. But, you know, in terms of the legally defined difference between hemp, industrial hemp, or marijuana, it comes down to the concentration, the presence of that one compound, THC.
So when farmers begin growing fields of industrial hemp, because we do have the passage of the new program, is it going to look as if they were growing fields of marijuana? Would it look the same?
Well, possibly. Again, it depends on what the intended product is going to be. You know, a field that is grown strictly for fiber production is not going to potentially look the same as a field that is being grown for, say, CBD production or you know, chemical extraction. You know, think about the comparison I like to make is with some other crops, you know, the difference between, say, like field corn and sweet corn. You know, they're both the same plant species. They're grown for different purposes. You know, same with some other crops, too, like broccoli, cauliflower, you know, some of our common crops. You know, they're the same plant. They're just different cultivars, different growth forms. So they may look slightly different, but essentially they're, you know, the same plant, the same general appearance.
So for the most part, they look the same. You mentioned that they're going to smell the same. It sounds like it could be very difficult to distinguish a difference.
You know, I'm a botanist, so, and, you know, botanists will look at this a little differently because it's the same plant, two different cultivars of the same plant. But I think it would be the distinction needs to be made, and this could be part of where a confusion is the legal distinction. So marijuana and hemp are, you know, legally separated now.
You're listening to Statewide. I'm Jacqueline Driscoll, and I'm talking with Chance Riggins about the differences and similarities between industrial hemp and marijuana. Chance, you just spoke about the confusion some people have with hemp and marijuana because they are the same plant. But as we've discussed, they're very different. No psychoactive components in industrial hemp as there is in marijuana. So why do you think people conflate the two? Is it because decades ago the federal government made the entire cannabis plant illegal and with that it included industrial hemp?
Well, that's true. But, you know, I think you have to take in consideration just the history of you know, cannabis in our culture in the U.S. With the drug laws, all the stigmas that, you know, has been associated with the plant over the last, you know, 40, 50, 60 years. So I think, you know, certainly there's that contributes to the confusion now.
Is there a way to eliminate or at least clear up the confusion, the stigma associated with industrial hemp?
Yeah, obviously, this is a, you know, a good step of, you know, with the Farm Bill and the roles that, you know, the states are playing and kind of setting their own laws, establishing, or, you know, with the acceptance of medical marijuana. But hemp is, again, you know, it's a different product. It's a different cultivar. There's a whole bunch of other uses, industries that are being supported by hemp products.
Now, you may look at this a little differently as a botanist because hemp and marijuana are the same plant. But do you find it odd that Illinois was just able to pass an industrial hemp bill after years of trying and failing, but it's coming right on the heels of a possible recreational marijuana program?
Well, again, that's true. I think, you know, hemp has got kind of a you know, it's a legacy, again, you know, the stigma that it's had over the decades, the confusion around the different cultivars, different uses, then just the legal jurisdictions, the different agencies involved. Of course, you know, it's certainly in a confusing position, and with the new prospects of recreational marijuana, that's going to add to it. I think it's going to be increasingly important for. It's probably going to take some time, too, for the laws to be worked out and really firmly establishing the jurisdictions in this state and also federally across states. Different states take different positions on this. But again, I think it still is very important to be specific when talking about hemp and its uses and its cultivation. Hemp now is an agricultural commodity with, you know, the passage of the Farm Bill. So I think focusing on that form, that variety as an agricultural crop, multiple uses, you know, as states adopt this and researchers are allowed to study it and provide agronomic data just like for any other crop. And then hopefully, you know, public opinion and the information for legislators and everybody else will kind of follow in line and people will make that distinction.
So with your expertise in the area and studying the plant, do you foresee any challenges ahead for the brand new industrial hemp program here in Illinois?
It's going to be critical for farmers, to growers, and this is one of the, I think, going to be one of the challenges too, is to establish some type of system for making sure that those levels are maintained the way that they are. Now, in other states, there are certified seed programs, so you know that, you know, the seed that you're, if you're a grower and you're interested in growing hemp, you know, where are you going to get your seed, for example? There aren't too many, you know, places to get seed now. You can't just go in the, you know, a seed catalog of any vendor and order cannabis seeds. So there are certified seed programs, and those things, as we start growing more, are going to be, you know, I'm sure going to be becoming more important. And then if you add recreational marijuana on top of that, then that's going to add a whole other level of complexity. You know, growers, you know, that's one of the things with this new licensing program. Growers, it's going to be their responsibility to justify that the plants that they're growing in their field, even though they look like marijuana or the different cultivars, don't have that high level of THC. So therefore, you know, they can confirm that they are growing hemp and not the, you know, marijuana or one of the other forms with that THC. So it's going to be really kind of difficult, I think, at first. And again, as we move forward and if we adopt recreational marijuana and start determining or establishing, you know, who can, you know, partake in that, who can grow that, the distribution chain, I mean, it could potentially get very complicated. I mean, the growers aren't the only ones with a lot of questions.
Jacqueline Driscoll speaking with Chance Riggins about the difference between industrial hemp and marijuana. Listening to Statewide. For 2 years in a row, the average U.S. life expectancy has declined. The director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention attributes that situation mainly to a rise in suicides and opioid overdoses. Though life expectancy has remained steady in Illinois, suicide and opioid-related deaths have climbed steeply. For this week's Illinois Issues, Maureen McKinney looks into what connection might exist.
When Maria Louisa Tucker's father died after swallowing a sizable amount of a prescribed opioid, hydrocodone, she saw it as a personal tragedy for her family. But after investigating the opioid crisis and the connection to mental health issues, the journalist said she took a broader view of her dad's 2006 suicide.
And that's sort of when a light bulb went on for me. And I realized, like, oh, well, you know, maybe the hydrocodone played a bigger part in my father's death than I had thought. And maybe this wasn't just a personal tragedy for me. Maybe this was something that had been repeating itself.
Tucker's not alone in thinking there could be a clearer link than what's been widely reported in the medical community. Jill Harkavy-Friedman is Vice President for Research at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention.
I think we're all wondering about the connection between suicide deaths and opioid deaths. And it's likely that there are some connections for some of the deaths, and then for other deaths, not as much of a connection. The issue is that many times people who are suicidal might be using substances like opioids, and vice versa. So there can be a lot of overlap. And it can be very hard to tell when somebody died, was it an accident? Or did they purposely die by suicide?
Harkavy Friedman's organization is funding a year-long study beginning this month that will look for connections. The researchers will take information from about 100 relatives of those who died by their own hand, as well as people who lost loved ones to opioid use and other drug-related causes. That will be compared against information gleaned from those who have experienced loss because of traumatic causes such as aggressive cancer or heart failure. The importance of the research is to help survivors as they struggle to make sense of a seemingly senseless death. The researcher wrote that as suicide rates and opioid deaths climb, it is imperative to identify the most effective forms of support for those survivors. Suicides in Illinois are up 26% this decade. Meanwhile, opioid deaths have skyrocketed to more than 22,000, a number more than doubled over a four-year period. Nationally, opioid-related deaths are the highest they've ever been, and the number of suicides hasn't been larger in the 50 years the data has been tracked by the federal government. Joseph Triani, a licensed clinical drug counselor and psychology professor at Adler University in Chicago, calls this combination of suicides and opioid overdoses, along with the rise in self-inflicted gun deaths, a perfect storm.
In addiction, you lose everything. You lose your family. You lose your dignity. You lose your job. One has to resort to things that they might never have dreamed of doing. As a result of their addiction. And as one addict said to me who survived a suicide, he said, "Doc, you get sick and tired of being sick and tired. And, you know, this looks like the best option out. You know, I've got to end it for myself. I've got to end it for everyone that I've hurt. I don't want to go on hurting people as a result of my addiction."
Triani says some of the keys to tackling the issue are education of the public and the medical community, and maybe most importantly, an increase in services.
When somebody is ready for help or wanting help, desperation occurs when that help is not available. And if it's not available, the option of suicide becomes very real as a way out.
I'm Maureen McKinney.
You can read more of that story. Just go to our website, statewideshow.com. All of our episodes are there. And that wraps up this week, Statewide. Thanks for joining us. Be with us again next time. And if you're on Facebook, you can like our page. Just look for Statewide Show. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.